You've tuned in to Columbia Calling, your first stop for everything you want to know about Columbia. How and where to invest, where to visit. From the Pacific to the Caribbean, the Andes Mountains to the Amazon jungle, Columbia has a slice of everything. Shooting from the hip, answering the questions that need answering. Here's your host, the journalist and hotelier Richard McCall, shedding some light on the fashionable South American destination of Columbia.
It's that time of the week again, folks. This is me, your host, Richard McCall, here in Bogota, Colombia, 2,600 meters closer to the stars. And this is episode 315 of the Columbia Calling podcast. 315 episodes it's taken us to get author, cycling enthusiast, expert on Columbia, Matt Rendell, on this show. And so he'll be back in segment three, talking about his latest book, Colombia es Pasión. And it's a really interesting and certainly a more profound look at cycling and the importance that the road cycling sport has for Colombia. And I know this is going to be a great episode for all of you out there who are interested even slightly in Colombia. So I am very, very pleased with this episode 315. And yes, well, in other news, we've got coronavirus now in Colombia, and that's not great news, but we knew it was going to happen. It's remains to be seen how much the government has done to ensure a robust plan to protect the citizens, but we'll see. It's been a tough few weeks for the government of President Iván Duque. You can see on my blog, I've got a week in the life of President Iván Duque 1, 2, and 3. That's parts 1, 2, and 3 written on there, because honestly, I've never seen anything like it ever at all surrounding politics. Not even here, not even in Guatemala, where I lived before. It's nothing short of remarkable what's going on. And of course, in final news, you'll see that we've got a new website. And those of you who've made donations and have sponsored the Columbia Calling podcast, this is for you. Thank you again, because those of you who gave us a little bit of money, we've been able to set up a proper professional website. So check it out at columbiacalling.co. That's columbiacalling.co. That doesn't mean that the Richard McCall website is now redundant. It's just Columbia Calling has his own website. And on there, you can find, there's a couple of ways of donating money, not only the Patreon page, but also buymeacoffee.com. And you can just make donations for as little as a cup of coffee. Every little thing helps and counts. So I would like to thank you all for your support and continued support. So this week we've got Matt Rendell on the show, and next week we'll be talking to Elizabeth Dickinson from the International Crisis Group, and we'll be talking about Cauca and the complications in the southwest of Colombia. So two very good shows for you to look forward to. Anyway, I'm going to leave you in the capable hands and the news segment from Columbia Reports. That's the director of Columbia Reports, Adrian Alsimer in Medellin, and then I'll be back in segment three with Matt Rendell. Thank you for listening, and don't go away.
My name is Adrian Alsimer, and this is the news for Columbia Calling for March 10, 2020. The legitimacy of President Iván Duque has come into question over evidence that the mafia was involved in rigging the 2018 elections. Journalists revealed that José Guillermo Hernández, the late money launderer of drug trafficker Marquitos Figueroa, coordinated vote buying ahead of the second round of elections. This would have been done through former President Álvaro Uribe's personal assistant, who is a close friend of Hernández's wife. A helicopter and a vehicle that were supposed to have been seized were used for the campaign. The Supreme Court announced a new investigation against Uribe. Criminal charges against Duque were filed before Congress Accusations Committee. Chief Prosecutor Francisco Barbosa, a personal friend of Duque, was accused of shadowing the journalists instead of investigating the alleged election rigging. President Iván Duque met with the Secretary General of the United Nations on Monday after relations sank to an all-time low. The Duque administration responded furiously to multiple UN reports confirming the government's gross human rights violations. The tensions are particularly high over human rights and counter-narcotics agencies that reported the Security Council. Multiple foreign countries have expressed their support for the UN agencies that are accused of lying by the government. The health ministry activated a contingency plan after confirming the first case of coronavirus in the country. According to President Ivan Duque, I quote, "Colombia has great experience in managing epidemics like this." Authorities previously announced the screening of incoming visitors, but this has been denied by incoming visitors. Cocaine production in Colombia broke a new all-time record in 2019, according to the US government. The claim is a punch in the gut for President Ivan Duque, who stepped up forced eradication of coca, but without effect. In an improvised meeting, US President Donald Trump told Duque, "You're going to have to spray." Colombia's government can only resume aerial spraying of coca if it complies with a crop substitution program that is part of the country's peace process, the Constitutional Court reminded Duque last week. The International Committee of the Red Cross said it registered a discouraging increase in conflict-related violence last year. According to the ICRC, the peace process improved the situation significantly in many parts of the country, but this was countered by outbreaks of violence in isolated areas. The ICRC urged the government to implement a 2016 peace deal with the FARC to prevent a further surge in conflict-related violence. That's the end of this week's news bulletin. Now back to Colombia Calling with Richard McCall.
And we're back. This is Colombia Calling, episode 315. I'm Richard McCall, as you know, here in Bogota, Colombia, 2,600 meters closer to the stars. And my very special guest this week is on the line from the UK. And some of you have been in touch in the past to ask for this guy to be on the show. And so it's a great pleasure of mine to invite and introduce you to Matt Rendell, journalist, author of 5 books about Colombia. And of course, we've got him on the show not only for his book Reyes de las Montañas, Kings of the Mountains, about cycling in Colombia, but of course the new book that will be in bookstores at the end, well, towards the end, second half of March, called Colombia es Pasión, the generation of racing cyclists who changed their nation and the Tour de France. Welcome on Colombia Calling, Matt Rendell.
Richard, thank you very much. It's about time, isn't it? Number's 315, and I haven't been on the show yet.
Well, you know.
I don't know how to feel about that.
Well, it works well with this new book coming out, and congratulations on that. Tell us how this book came about, a book about cycling in Colombia, but in English.
Yeah, well, I've written 4 books about Colombia, 3 of them about cycling. All in English. Mm-hmm. One of them, which has been published in Spanish, which is Reyes de las Montañas, King of the Mountains. Mm-hmm. And this one came about, I suppose, because since 2011, I think, I haven't written. And because I didn't really have anything to write about. There was nothing that really grabbed me. And then I worked for the movie star team in 2016, briefly and slightly unhappily, which has provided me with some insight into why Naira was so keen to leave. We can talk about that. And then in 2017, I worked for the Trek Segafredo team, got the end of 2017, and there wasn't much happening for 2018, and I thought, right, time to write a book about this generation of cyclists. I've known Nairo since the last day of March 2011.
Wow.
I've known the people who sort of created and ran the Colombia Espacion team since the noughties. Mm-hmm. I think that's the way it's supposed to be said. And so I thought, right, well, golden generation. What is it? 14, Grand Tour podiums for Colombian riders between 2013 and 2019. Time to write something about that. And so that's what I've done. And the title is, it's not intended to be a book that's solely about the team, Colombia es Pasión. It is intended to be a book about Colombia and about the historical moment and the circumstances and the whole context that led to the Colombia es Pasión campaign, which started in about 2005 under Luis Guillermo Plata, who was the head of what at the time was called Pro Export, the now Pro Colombia. And so it was about that moment where Colombia was transforming itself, and there was a lag in perception in the outside world. And so, you know, a cycling team and a campaign was launched to close that lag, and hence cycling. And suppose it's a book about, in a sense, how cycling has given Colombia a form of a fabulous and unprecedented form of soft power in the world that has, as part of this enormous kind of feedback loop, helped both being the product of Colombian development in its positive and its negative manifestations, and has driven that development to a degree by giving what I suppose marketeers would call, marketing experts would call, global name recognition and sort of normalization. So it's softened Colombia's international image. So that's a little bit how the book came about.
Well, I think it's fantastic. And I think this, as you say, this sort of soft publicity that's so positive. I mean, we're looking at, and I think part of the interest that is drawn, of course, and will be drawn to the book is these guys, you know, they come from hard backgrounds, from very humble beginnings. This is the, let's say, the rags to riches, if you want, if you wish, the story. And you know, these are humble guys. I like it. We know about it. Friends of mine have started the sort of, what's it called? La Leyenda mountain bike race. It's a multi-stage mountain bike. And you know, some of the mountain bikers are being overtaken on these stretches by young kids on roads, you know, which are unpaved roads, and with bicycles with no gears. And I think the same upbringing as people like Egan Bernal, Nairo Quintana, and others. I mean, you've known these guys. You put some dates back there, the noughties and 2011. Tell us a little bit about them, about these cyclists, these phenomenal athletes.
Yeah, well, years ago I wanted to write John McLaughlin, the jazz guitarist, and I was told, look, there's no story there. You know, the story is the black jazz musician who's come from the streets, or you know, and I'm not sure I quite agree with that really, but and so there is a kind of tendency in publishing, in journalism, to want to see a rags to riches story. You know, Naira, of course, would vehemently deny that he was ever that he ever suffered any form of poverty. He said, "Yeah, we didn't have cash, but we had food and love and a caring family and a good education and a supportive community and so on." Funnily enough, a friend of mine came with me to Colombia a year ago. He'd never been to Colombia before, and I took him to those landscapes outside Tunja where Nairo was grown up, and he sort of stood there and looked and said, "It's amazing, isn't it? And you look at these landscapes and this altitude, and you wonder how a kid from South Wales like Geraint Thomas could ever compete with them." And I kind of had to correct him about that, because, you know, of course, yeah, they've got altitude and they've got every reason to want to escape from a collapsing rural economy. But of course, what they don't have is everything else, all the other advantages that kids from, you know, Europe and North America have, which is, of course, quite apart from structures that allow them to, access to, you know, the latest in training techniques and technology and teams, structured teams who are traveling and they get used to the whole, all the accoutrements of racing. What they don't have also is that kind of, you know, more or less slightly difficult, slightly testing semi-match between purchase power and what the marketplace offers in terms of, you know, cycling equipment and all the technology and expertise in training and so on. You know, what a peasant farmer producing potatoes or onions or coffee at prices that barely cover production costs. You know, there isn't cash left over to spend on these things, to spend on all the expertise that's available. So that's a tremendous disadvantage. And one of the things I was interested in was the way that, okay, in 1991, you had the economic opening of Colombia, La Apertura. And come 2000, round about the year 2000, immediately you know, I can name instantly, Nairo's family lost some land because they were producing potatoes at below at over market prices. The production costs were higher than market prices, and there was some debt, and there was just a, you know, in this fluctuating rural economy, it caught them just at the wrong moment, just in the moment of weakness, and they lost a field at the back of the house. The Atapuma family in Nariño, Darwin Atapuma's family, they were providing barley to the malt house in Ipiales, and the malt house in Ipiales closed in the year 2000, effectively made unviable by cheap subsidized imports of barley from the US, and the bottom fell, and suddenly 100% of all traded barley in Colombia was foreign, and the bottom fell out of that market. So Darwin Atapuma's, not eldest, not second, but the third brother, Remigio, he, very, very smart guy, sold some, raised a kind of bumper crop, sold it, sold some horses too, moved away from the countryside to Tuqueres, and opened a bike shop. And then he set about making his younger brother a champion. Yeah. And then at the same time, another example in Pesca, 25, 30K out of Sogamoso, Miguel Angel Lopez, his father told me, look, 70% of this valley used to be under cultivation, and now it's about 20%, you know. And so in all those cases, you have the younger brothers. Nairo's number four of five. Miguel Angel is, I think, number four of seven. And Darwin is number nine of nine. So you had the younger brother of these peasant farming siblings finding some space for themselves and using cycling as not initially a way out, but as a way of finding a sense of fulfillment, an absorption, and a way of you know, something they loved doing, a kind of that kind of emotional luxury that is quite hard to come by in a hard peasant farming upbringing. So they are all the products, in a sense, of the crisis in the rural economy that came about following the 1991 economic opening. And what's happening, what's going to happen more and more, is you're going to have another generation of peasant farming kids who are the product of the free trade deals of the Uribe era and the Santos era. And so there'll be another massive wave. There'll be another wave of economic crisis in the campesinato. So it's all very much connected to that that peasant farming economy and its collapse. Yeah.
It's so interesting, and of course the humility that you mentioned there, Nairo Quintana, who's who vehemently reject any issue of let's say necessity in his home. They had food on the table and a roof over their heads, education and so on. But this link to the economy is something. Of course, you've gone far deeper into this story than let's say a flash in the pan rags to riches tale. You've actually gone behind it. I would say it's almost like a social sciences type of study into cycling in Colombia. I have to ask, so how did you become interested in Colombia and indeed cycling?
There are a number of reasons. I mean, I think one of them is just the way that you're set up, the way that you're wired up in terms of personality. And I'm happen to be wired up in the way that I like to challenge my beliefs. I think when we've all got a belief system. We all see the world in a certain way, and you can either kind of hibernate within it. That's one way of experiencing, of living your belief system. Or you can, when you find yourself challenged, when you find your beliefs challenged, you can say, okay, well, what then are the foundations of the way I see the world? And how can it be that this other person who's challenging me sees the world in such a completely different way? And so you become fascinated by people who see the world in a different way. And I think I've always been a bit like that. And I've always been, I suppose, a bit of a misfit. And when I, many years ago, cycled the length of, or not quite the length of South America, but I took my mountain bike and rode up Chile and Argentina and through Bolivia and into Peru. And I sort of had this vague idea of making it to Colombia, but that was never the plan. Eventually, I sold my bikes. I ran out of money. And I did make it to Colombia. And partly the reason was that everyone said, you don't want to go to Colombia. And, that's a dangerous place. And I thought, well, if it's as dangerous and inaccessible as everyone says, how come it has a population of 45 million? how come? So there was a bit of that. More concretely, in 1997, I was working as a translator in Channel 4 in the television studios in London. Channel 4 showed the Tour de France, and an interview came to me with Chepe Gonzalez, the best rider at the time, I think, from Sogamoso. And he was asked about doping in cycling, and very ingenuously, because he was, of course, doped, and as a great many of them were. He said, well, we don't have doping in Colombia because we've got pisos térmicos. And I had no idea what pisos térmicos were. And I hunted high and low, and I called friends from every Latin American nation. I didn't know anyone who was Colombian. I got nowhere. No one knew what pisos térmicos were. And eventually, I'd studied in Paris, and I knew that there was a Latin radio station called Radio Latina in Paris that belonged to Caracol. It belonged to a Colombian company. So I thought, well, there's bound to be a Colombian there. And I found a telephone number on the internet, phoned them up, said, look, this is going to sound pretty bizarre, but I'm sitting in a basement in a television studios in London. I'm translating something from the Tour de France, and there's a Colombian rider, and he's mentioned pisos térmicos. Anyway, they explained the pisos térmicos. Okay, we have altitude. That was all it was. So that was fine. And then and the guys who I've never spoken to again, and I don't know his name. I've got no idea who he was, and he was just charming. And he said, listen, give me your address, and whenever a Colombian wins, I'll send you the music that you can play when there's a Colombian victory. And he sent me a couple of CDs, or I think he might have sent me three or four, among them Yuri Buenaventura singing Colombia Tierra Querida. And I thought, first of all, Chepe, who I translated the interview with, he had these wonderful, fiery, kind of backlit brown eyes, and everything was gracias a Dios, si Dios quiere, and so on and so forth. And I was kind of attracted by it. I thought, you know, hey, we don't get much spirituality in world sport, you know, and for a translator, it's quite a difficult thing to do because sport is presented in the UK on the whole as a sort of as an agnostic activity, and someone who pursues their sport for spiritual reasons or with that spiritual dimension, it's quite difficult to know what to do with it, how to translate that, how to put that in a language that doesn't just make people feel uncomfortable. So that's quite an interesting cross-cultural problem. So I was interested by Chepe. I thought, you know, he sounds like a fascinating guy, a nice and a fascinating guy. And then my nameless friend in Radio Latina in Paris, I thought, well, I'm actually, I like charming, friendly, generous, warm
yes.
people. I want to know more. I must go to Colombia. And wow. So I did.
And there's the story. That's a lovely story. I love it that it came out of a basement somewhere in a faceless building in London for Channel 4, being a translator. And then it's emerged, you know, you've emerged as the, you know, five books about Colombia, cycling, yeah, you know, foremost probably expert in these topics. But you touched on something there, doping. I have to ask, and I know that my listeners, yeah. I mean, okay, so Colombia has pisos térmicos, but there must be doping. I mean, cycling is rife with it, surely.
Yes, totally.
Yeah.
It's a massive problem. And what's happened, of course, is that you had and this is very much part of the story. So the cycling team Colombia Es Pasión was created in 2006. I was at the start of the 2006. Vuelta a Colombia in San Cristobal in Táchira province in Venezuela. And the day before the race was due to start, blood tests were held. Something of the order of the high 50s, 58, something like that, were should have been prevented from racing. So, of course, the Cycling Federation threw them all away, sent an email around, told everyone that they should expect more tests the following day, and please get everyone in order. And so they retested everyone, and I think there were 7 or 8 positives, which anywhere else would have been a huge scandal, but in Colombian cycling was a pretty good result. And so the race began. And among the riders the first time round who'd been positive were riders from Colombia Es Pasión, and there were ructions. And the president of the team, who at the time was very external to the team, was very sort of supervisory, but very distant from the day-to-day running, was a Stanford University-educated mathematician, expert in statistical analysis and big numbers, big data, called Ignacio Vélez. And he said, look, we either close the team or it's going to work the way, you know, I'm telling you it's got to work. So he brought in people from outside. He got rid of a lot of staff, brought new people in. Luis Fernando Saldarriaga, the best coach in Latin America, who in his post there, and a rabid and trenchant anti-doper, Luis Fernando Rios, who was a former competitor in adventure sports and an event organizer. And she was brought in. She said, when I joined the team, I didn't even know what a peloton was or what a breakaway was. I knew nothing about cycling. And Ignacio said, good, that's the way I want it. That's what this sport needs. And they created this oasis of, as I say, trenchant anti-doping. Luisa Rios brought with her Colsanitas, who you know is one of the private health firms in Colombia. And Colsanitas conducted their own biological passport program within the team. They were there's no UCI. UCI is the organization that governs world cycling. They have a biological passport scheme. You have to enroll in it, and there has to be, you know, a given chain of custody available to you so that you can send samples to the authorized laboratories. Well, none of that existed anywhere in Latin America, and I'm pretty certain it doesn't exist now. Certainly doesn't in Bogota, because the laboratory has been decertified, was decertified, I think, in February 2017, and there's still no anti-doping lab in Colombia. So Colsanitas, paid for privately by the team, ran their own biological passport program. And years later, when Nairo went to Europe, he was able to say, here is my biological passport. And people were amazed. But that's what got the riders their jobs in the World Tour, effectively. But because of that anti-doping stance, and Ignacio used to say, we represent a country that for most of the world is associated with one thing, drugs. So when they talk and write about our cycling team, the two words Colombia and drugs cannot be allowed to occur in the same sentence. So there can be no doping in this team, okay, which is fabulous. So immediately that team was loggerheads, in frontal collision with the entirety of Colombian cycling culture, yeah, of the domestic scene. And Juan Pablo Villegas, who was one of the sort of standard bearers of the team, really the soul of that team, who now, he's recently retired, and he's now the national coach in Panama, just about to start that job. He gave a famous interview to a wonderful website that I'm sure your listeners are aware of, called Alps and Andes, or the Cycling Inquisition, run by Klaus Bellon. And he gave Klaus a wonderful interview in which he said, look, you know, we'd go to Europe and we're everything, and then we come to Colombia and we couldn't put a rider in the top 50, you know, and people would be laughing at us. And actually there were death threats and so on and so forth because of this anti-doping stance. So, it's quite a story. And because of the kind of conflict between the Colombia Espacion staff and riders and team and the Colombian cycling milieu, in 2012, effectively the team was discontinued. Their half of their funding was taken away. They kind of became a tiny little development team, and the money went into Team Colombia, which was effectively, they took seven of Colombia Espacion's riders, including Esteban Chavez, of course, a wonderful future he had. Yeah. But it created, there was a whole conflict there. And yeah. It's quite a story to hear. Well, I can hear that your son is very moved by
this. He's
that
moved. He's 2 months old. To my listeners, I apologize. I'm home alone. But it's fantastic. I love this anti-doping stance. I mean, really. And of course, Colombia cannot be associated with further drugs, let's say. It's such a damaging situation. But let's wind back. I mean, obviously, you've had to do all sorts of investigations and you know, profound research. The history of cycling in Colombia, I mean, you know, when you do a rudimentary search, and what I've been doing because of my certain investigations that I'm doing, of course, they like to say that it's Donald Ruskin, you know, the Englishman who was over in 19 whatever, son of a
in the 40s,
in the 40s, who his father imported, I think it was English flannel over here to make suits, or pano inglés, as they say here, and then he brought over bicycles. That's the, you know, people always seem to talk about that as being the beginnings of the cycling culture, but it was here before then, I believe.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Well, I mean, there were Halcyon bikes imported into Cali in the 1930s. Yeah. And there were certainly, the first bikes seem to have come to Cali and to Bogota, possibly through Buenaventura, in the end of the 19th century. So, I mean, there have been bikes around for a long time, and there was a prominent French family in Cali in the 1930s who imported Halcyon bikes, which were, you know, they were kind of the Treks or the Specialized or the Colnagos of the day, you know. And there was certainly a cycling scene in the 1940s, because otherwise there wouldn't have been an Efraín Forero to create the Vuelta a Colombia. And there wouldn't have been a Vuelta a Colombia, which really, the distinguishing thing about the Vuelta a Colombia was, A, it was the first stage race, and B, it was the first race to get the backing of a major sponsor like El Tiempo, who could publish and inform the public and turn it into a kind of media phenomenon.
Yeah.
But I think, to me, the interesting thing is, ultimately, in whenever it was, November 1950, Efraín Ferrero, who'd been hammering on and boring people senseless with this idea of, look, why don't we have a Vuelta a Colombia? Why don't we have a Vuelta a Colombia? In conscious and direct imitation of the Tour de France, he eventually, you know, bored Enrique Santos, the owner of El Tiempo, into allowing him to attempt to ride up Les Tretras, the climb from Onda up to Manizales, basically. And he did it. And when he got to Manizales, there could have been one of two reactions. One of them would have been, you know, what, you rode your bike up Letras. Are you some sort of idiot? or they could have celebrated it, and they celebrated it, and they lifted him up and paraded him around the square as if he was a bullfighter. And that, to me, is very interesting, because, as I say, they could equally well have said, you know, this guy's an idiot. And that would have been the end, and there would have been no Colombian cycling. But something in the Colombian psyche was there, ready to embrace this activity, this kind of crazed act of self-harming, you know, that is attempting to ride a bike up 85 kilometers of unmade road. And so, in a sense, the history of what happened, the history of the facts, all that does is begs the question, why? And so what I'm trying to do is say why. And people, you know, in this sort of interview are always saying, so Matt, why Colombia?
Yeah.
And they go, well, look, I've written five books about it. So I've written this book's 320 pages. So I've probably written 2,000 pages on that subject. And I haven't come close to an answer. Yeah. But here are some of them.
Yeah.
You know, here are some of my sort of hypotheses.
Efraín is El Zipa, no?
Yeah, El Zipa, yeah.
El Zipa. So, the sort of, as they say, they're kind of the forefather of competitive cycling here. Fantastic stuff, though. I mean, so interesting. As you say, I think we're all trying to come to some sort of realization of how to write about Colombia and how to best explain the country a little bit more. But I love that. I mean, I come back to this original point. I love that you have been able to connect this golden generation and then, of course, the next golden generation with sort of, let's say, the free trade agreements create.
But I mean, that's just one dimension. I think you can go in a completely different direction. And I did this. I have a chapter on it. I should talk about for a second about the structure of the book before I go into tell you a little anecdote. But what it is, it's a very ambitious book.
Yeah.
And I'm quite nervous about how it'll be received, whether people will get it, and also whether I've managed to achieve my ambition. What I've wanted to do is tell the biographies of about 16 of the riders who have who've contributed to this, you know, enormous change in the way that Colombia is perceived around the world. And so each of those riders gets two or three chapters, And I tell it in a sense in chronological order, not so much of their birth, but of their achievements as cyclists. In telling that, I also need to tell, I need to put them in the context of the history of the Italian peasant class, of the peasantry and the peasant economy. And in order to do that, I have to put them in the context of the transformation of the economic and cultural transformation of Colombia, during the 20th century, essentially, and most specifically from 1950. So I need to tell that story and explain how Colombia has been transformed, and during that transformation, it has yielded, it's created this group of fabulously talented cyclists. And as I say, also show the way in which this group of fabulously talented cyclists have contributed to that transformation. But then in also to talk about the peasant class, you need to talk about history of the economic history of the past 500 years. And of course, if you're in Boyacá or Cundinamarca, campesino also means campesimbio. So you need to talk about their indigenous roots, and especially with Nairo, who from the house where he grew up in, out on the road between Tunja and, between Combita and Arcabuco, you can see the mountaintop where Lake Iguaque is. And Iguaque, of course, is the lake from which Bachué, the primeval woman in the narrative cycles of the Muisca people, from whom Nairo derives, from which Bachué emerged with an infant, and she populated the earth. So Nairo grew up within direct sight of the center of the earth, and that is fundamental to understanding Nairo, to understanding his inner world, and also his meaning to Colombia, because it's a bit like the Emperor's New Suit. What no one says, and what is absolutely obvious to everyone, especially Nairo, is that he is by far the darkest skinned incumbent of the podium of any Grand Tour in cycling history, and certainly of the Tour de France. So I've tried to tell that story. And in the chapter on Danny Martinez, who's another of these wonderful, wonderful, young, fabulously talented riders, I went to visit Danny Martinez and his family, peasant farming family, in Vergara, Cundinamarca. And we got talking, and he said, he spoke about his obsession with the yellow jersey. And I said to him, are you aware of the stories of El Hombre Amarillo, the yellow man? And he said, I'm not sure. And his uncle had been listening to us, walked into the room, and he said, I'll tell you about El Hombre Amarillo. And he told me this amazing story that raised the hairs on the back of my neck, because I'd read about this spirit who, when you throw the tunjo, the golden or wooden or stone figurine of the god into water, he becomes this golden or yellow spirit who appears whenever there's a flood. And he's, in a sense, he's a manifestation of Bochica, the bringer of culture. So Danny Martinez's uncle told me this story about when he was, this was about 47, 48 years before, there'd been the river had been very, very high, and the peasant family who lived by the river, they'd climbed to higher ground, their house had flooded, and they saw a little girl in a basket kind of float down the river, dressed in yellow with golden hair. And they shouted to her, you've got to get out, it's very dangerous. And she said, no, this isn't dangerous, but later my father will come, and then it'll be dangerous, and then you need to look out. And as I say, the hairs raised on the back of my neck, because I'd read about these stories in the folk culture of the uh, uh, of of the highlands of Cundinamarca and Boyacá. But I'd never spoken to a peasant farmer who could tell me these stories and from his personal experience. And I said to Danny, you see, you're the heir to a colour symbolism in which yellow is absolutely fundamental. And so your obsession with the yellow jersey of the Tour de France doesn't just date back 50, 70 years now to the first Vuelta a Colombia, or even to 1903 in the first, or well, 1918 in the first yellow jersey in the Tour de France, but it dates back hundreds, maybe thousands of years. And so the roots of Colombian cycling, even in this indigenous colour symbol that highlights a colour that by pure coincidence is the colour of the jersey of the Tour de France, that's something very, very deeply ingrained in the culture. So as soon as anyone says, so why Colombia, why cycling? As Freud said, interpretation is infinite, you know, and you can go back you can go back 10,000 years and keep going back. And so that for that reason, for me, it's endlessly exciting and fascinating.
That's just an incredible story. And an incredible, opening into understanding and, well, actually making me incredibly excited to read the book. You know, it's not just
good. Well, that's the effect I want to make. I'm excited.
Well, no, because it goes so much further. I don't want to read a full 320 pages about someone, you know.
Across a road.
Overtaking on certain paths and so on and so forth. I want to know further. But that's me, and I think it hopefully is the majority too.
I hope so. And I always feel that I think, like any writer, you write the books that you want to read. Mm-hmm. And as I say, this one is I think probably it comes across from that anecdote and from others that how ambitious this book is. And my fear is it may be lost on a lot of sports fans. But also what I hope is that maybe this is just arrogance, the arrogance of the author, but you do want people to come out and say, do you know what? The way I see reality has just been nudged, has just been, you know, shaken. And I now see, you know, the colours seem brighter and the smells and the sounds seem more vivid now. And ultimately what I'd like people to do is to read it and to say, wow, Colombia must be something special, because it is something special. Yes. And this is probably my feeling, Richard, for people. I mean, obviously not the people that are listening to your podcast who have that interest, but a lot of people, this will be the only book they've ever read about, they ever read about Colombia. And so I feel that there's a kind of moral obligation to sort of say, it's not about white lines across roads and which wheel gets there first. It's about something way more fascinating and disturbing and deep and shocking and challenging to the way you see the world. And so that's the intention I go in with. God knows what I come out with.
Expect to see you doing the rounds here in Bogotá in Colombia very soon with this book, The Book Tour in Colombia.
Excellent. Well, I hope it'll happen. At the moment, the thing is, it's quite a big, fat volume. Mm. And what I don't want to do is abridge it, because as you can probably imagine from what I've said so far, the beauty is in the detail, you know. And as soon as you start taking detail out, you start, one, impoverishing this extraordinary rich reality that is Colombia, and two, it ceases to become the book that it is, and it becomes a kind of, you know, standard sports biography or 16 sports biographies, and it ceases to see, what I hope that you can do, what I think, what the intention is, that you read these chapters that tell a biography, that tell a life, and as you move chapter to chapter to chapter, the background, Columbia, you gradually see it being transformed, you know? Yeah. And so it's, you're constantly kind of bouncing between the life of the rider and the life of the culture that both produced him and is being produced by this extraordinary success that affects everyone really in Colombia. So and what I don't want to do is abridge the book, and what I don't want to do is, for instance, have it published in Spain, where you know, maybe they can afford to translate it and sell it at a reasonable price. Because one, I don't want it to be in Spanish, in Spanish, if you like, in Iberian Spanish. Yeah. It should be in Colombian Spanish. And two, this is a book that's written for Colombia. I want to pay something back from all the love and warmth and friendship and experiences that Colombia's given me. This book is part of a gift exchange, and it's very, very important to me that it should be published in Colombia.
I'm certain it will do, and I can't think of a better way and more positive way than bringing this to an end. Unfortunately, I think we could listen to your anecdotes and your knowledge, really quite unbelievable knowledge about, let's say, the history and the myth and the spirituality around Colombia, and that you should say this is a book written for Colombia. It's very special. It's very poignant indeed. So let me take this time just to say thank you for your time today, being on the show, and I wish you all the best with this new book coming out. Everyone out there with any slight inkling of an interest in Colombia, do, you know, pick up a book. It's, you know, it's books. We love books. Colombia's Pasión, the generation of racing cyclists who changed their nation and the Tour de France. I wish you all the best, the greatest success with this book. I'm going to go onto Amazon now and pre-order my copy. So thank you again, Matt Rendell. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for having me, Richard, and I hope to speak to you again in a couple of years' time when I've got another book out.
Perfect. No, it's been a real pleasure. Wherever you buy your books, I'm sure you can pick up a copy of Matt Rendell's new book coming out very shortly, second half of March. This has been a fantastic episode of the Columbia Calling podcast. For those of you out there who want to hear more of the Columbia Calling podcast and want to help us grow and improve, we have a Patreon page where you can sponsor us for as little as $2 a month. Please check it out, patreon.com, Columbia Calling. We've been talking to Matt Rendell, author of 5 books about Columbia, cycling enthusiast, and best knowledge on all things Colombia, of course. So thank you again to him. This has been episode 315. I'm signing off today. Next week we will have an expert on here talking about some of the political situations in southwestern Colombia, in particular Cauca. So thank you again for listening, and goodbye.